David found a pension that his staff would love. He chose NatWest Cushion because it has a fantastic app that is easy to use. Everyone feels good, except David. He is ecstatic. Take a little more action with a NatWest Cushion workplace pension. Tomorrow begins today. Search NatWest Cushion. Capital at risk.
Hi, this is Stacy from The Advisor, and today I'm very excited because we have a very special guest today. Our special guest is Paul Joel, and he is the author of an amazing book called A Man Like You and Me. It's a supernatural book. But before we begin, I just want to give a shout out to our sponsor. It's dmaworld.com. And Mark, who is the owner of the company, just wants to let you know that he likes to help small businesses grow into big businesses. He doesn't want you to get scammed by those big marketing companies that take your money. He wants to be able to help companies that are starting out and that need their help so they can grow and they can not be scammed by those big marketing companies. So give Mark a call. Mark's web address again is dmaworld.com, and he's looking forward to hearing from you and he can't wait to help you. So give him a call, go to his website and ask him any questions you want. Now, to get back to our amazing story, now we have Paul Joel, the author, here today. And Paul, I wanted to ask you a quick question. What inspired you to become a writer and how did you get started on your journey?
Well, first off, I'm not a writer, okay? I'm probably the only person that's going to be on your show that says I'm an author of a book, but I'm not a writer, okay? I was kind of inspired to write this book, okay? It's about true, again, it's called A Man Like You and Me, A Supernatural Adventure Story, about true supernatural events. And again, I never believed in God when growing up because my parents' family was butchered in World War II by the Nazis. So my mother's the only one who survived, and her family, my father and his family. So I never believed in God, and you know, I always thought, well, where was he when this was happening? Was he on vacation? Was he deaf, dumb, and blind? He didn't care. Like, what, you know, what's the story here? And then I met my wife. I was a Pulmonary Fellow at Mass General at Harvard, and she was working in the ICU, and my life changed. Okay, she's brilliant. She's beautiful. Her smile lights up the room. She's charming. Nobody ever called me charming. Okay, I always felt that my job in life is to carry her bags. Like, she's so much better than me and everything. And you think, by the way, it would be great being married to like an out and out saint. Okay, I mean, she's the closest thing you'll ever see to a living, breathing saint. Okay, but it's actually annoying, to tell you the truth, because every day I see how she navigates life, and then it's kind of a slap in my face of, hey, I can't do that. Okay, I'm not that person. Okay, so it's actually the opposite. It's kind of annoying sometimes. Again, I had two things going for me. I had this great immune system and I had this terrific memory. And then I got sick on March 25th, 2019, when I got Hashimoto's encephalitis and everything was taken away. The memory was wiped out. The immune system was wiped out from chemotherapy, and life was awful. And at one point, and again, I'm no hero here. At one point, I called a priest who I knew. And said, look, is it okay if I stop eating and drinking? Because this is not a life. I have no memory. I'm a moron. And this way my wife could marry somebody else, okay? We're Catholic, you know, there's no divorce or whatever. And he said, go for it, okay? You know, God will understand. You're not committing suicide. You know, I'll understand this. But then one of my doctors who read the book, said, hey, if you think you're the person in that book who's supposed to get this consecration of Russia done by the Pope and unison with the bishops, you can't just quit on him. You're going to go to hell. You know, it's like Noah's being told to build the ark, and he says to God, no, thank you. I'm not building the ark. Well, that's not going to go well for him. Okay. And that's the only reason I'm still alive, because I listened to that. And then, so because nothing changed in my life, okay, and the memory was out, and I had all this chemotherapy for 2 years, eventually they just stopped the treatment, okay? And the parts of my brain responsible for memory were destroyed. But then a year later, off treatment, on April 29, 2022, miraculously, my memory came back. So I'm the only one that you'll ever interview that has the same lesion. I still have the MRI in my brain is the same, okay? So there should be no reason why I have a memory at all. But I'm kind of like a walking miracle.
Right.
Okay, to have this kind of memory. Again, I remember things when I was 17 months old. Okay, I'm sitting there in a high chair. I don't know how to talk. Okay, and I've got a plastic spoon and cup and whatever it is. And I'm trying to indicate to my mother that I'm done, but I don't know how to talk, so I'm just making noise. And she's kind of ignoring me. I'm 17 months old. So, of course, I take matters in my own hand, and I try to get out of the harness and stand up and take a header and slit open my chin here. We wound up going to the emergency room. That was 17 when I was 17 months old. So not that many people can remember stuff that long ago. Okay, and, of course, I remember when I was 3, when I wasn't talking, and I saw a pediatrician for the first time. And again, you're supposed to be able to say two words of meaning by the age of 1. Usually some form of mama, dad, but you have to know who's who and say two words. I'm 3 and I'm not saying anything. So a friend of my parent, and apparently I didn't have a pediatrician. So a friend of my parents said, hey, maybe you need to see a pediatrician. So I'm 3, it's 71 years ago. And I was seen by a female pediatrician who sent me to a male pediatric neurologist. And my parents were very worried that I was retarded. And he examined me and then he said, quote unquote, 71 years ago. No, he's not retarded, he's aware of his environment. I didn't know what environment meant, but I knew it was a good thing I was aware of it. He said, he'll learn to talk, he's just slow. He's very slow. Basically, he's dumb as a box of rocks, but he's not retarded. And that was the upshot of this. So because they worked multiple jobs and there was no daycare then, they put me in this thing called Yeshiva for Jewish boys, which is you get there at 8 o'clock in the morning. In the morning, you learn how to read and write Hebrew, the Old Testament, the history of the Jewish people. Then there's a break for lunch. Then in the afternoon, somebody comes in and teaches you what you learn in public school, reading, writing, arithmetic. And you're there from 8 in the morning till 5. And it's a long day, okay? And I was the dumbest kid in every subject. And I was very frustrated. And I remember being dumb, okay? And then we moved to a different part of Brooklyn. And that was worse because I had the same schedule. I had to take a bus ride for 6 miles to Yeshiva Rabbi David Leibowitz. And all of these people there, the teachers who were getting me, had dark hair like I have. And same thing at this place. New kids, new school, dumbest kid in the class. And if I get the answer wrong, I get smacked over the hand with a ruler or whatever. So I got little scars on the tops of my fingers from this. And then towards the end of third grade, Mr. Tandler, who taught the public school part, said he needs to talk to me after class. And I was worried because I wasn't going to get a medal for being dumb. And he said, look, I don't know what's going on with you, but when you're in class and I ask you a question, you seem to have some idea what's happening. But when you take these tests, you're the worst student I've ever had in my entire teaching career. Don't you study for the test? So I told him the story that I'm dumb when I was 3. And I don't get home till 6, and I got to grab some food by myself, and there's Hebrew homework to do, and why should I waste my time studying? I'm dumb. And he said, you know, study for the test, and aren't here your schedule here. So about 2 weeks later, he announces in the class that there's a test, and in a loud voice to embarrass the crap out of me, he says, and you, do you understand? There's a test tomorrow. Study for the test, and I want to hear about your schedule. There's a test tomorrow. Do you understand English, or is English a second language for you? And that kind of hurt because everyone in that class was like, you know, you children of immigrants. And my father did have a tough time with English, okay? So I studied for the test and got an A. Who the hell knew? And I started getting A's in all these things. And so, again, I'm in this yeshiva, and they all have dark hair, and they're all hitting me. And so I talk my way into public school for fifth grade, thinking maybe I'll be able to take this test for SP in sixth grade, okay? Mm-hmm. And if you do well, you skip eighth grade. And for me, having one less year of school was terrible. It was great. And also, public school is 9 to 3. It's not 8 to 5, okay? But unfortunately, I had another teacher there who had dark hair. Of course, I remember her name. And she hated all the boys. She loved the girls and hated the boys. And she would say disgusting things like, I get the answer wrong. She'd say, you need to stop thinking with your penis and start using your brain for a change. And I was like horrified. I'm 10. And then finally, I got into the smartest sixth grade, and I had Miss Hammer, who's blonde. And for the first time, nobody was embarrassing me or hitting me, and school was normal. So in the back of my head, I think I was already pre-programmed to think blonde is wholesome, blonde is good, okay? These other people with dark hair, maybe they're nice like me. I'm a nice guy, okay? But others are animals, okay? So fast forward, I'm now an intern at Kings County Hospital, Brooklyn, New York. The pulmonary service is run by Dr. Howard Lyons, his genius. And he did things differently. Normally, the underling reads his note. And so you're on, on call, you have three or four admissions. Next morning is morning report with him. And he took the charts.
David found a pension that his staff would love. He chose NatWest Cushion because it has a fantastic app that is easy to use. Everyone feels good, except David. He is ecstatic. Take a little more action with a NatWest Cushion Workplace Pension. Tomorrow begins today. Search NatWest Cushion. Capital at risk.
He said, if you know the patient, you don't need the chart. You're supposed to memorize everything on that chart. And I could do that. I was the only one in that group who could do it. Others would kind of cheat and say, well, the labs are normal except for this, this, and this, but I memorized everything. So because of his letter of reference, I got to do a pulmonary fellowship at Harvard, Mass General. So I'm there the first day. There are eight patients on the service, thinking I'm supposed to memorize this. I get there 2 hours beforehand, memorize everything on these eight charts. This is an amazing memory that I never appreciated that I had, okay? And then I meet the attending, Dr. Hales. I walk over to the chart rack and hand him the chart. And he looks at me like I'm crazy and says, look, I don't know if you know what's going on here, but I'm the attending, I'm your superior. You're supposed to present the case to me, not the other way around. And then I told him what Dr. Lyons said, and he knew Dr. Lyons. And I said, this will save you time. You can listen to me present the case, go through the chart now, and write your note now instead of coming back and writing notes. So he did that for the first patient. And then I give him the chart for the next one. He says, you know this one too? I said, yeah, I know all eight of them. Finally, we get to the ICU. Okay, there's a very complicated patient on a ventilator with tubes coming out of every orifice. There's a lot to memorize, okay? And so he's standing on my right. I'm looking straight ahead. He has the chart. And as I'm looking at this, I see the back of this nurse's head. And I was there 2 hours beforehand. There's a shift change. This is a new nurse. And I'm tracing her long blonde hair. And I'm thinking, okay, the width of her shoulders isn't wide. She's not fat. And then she turns around and I see her face. And I said to myself, oh my God, this is the most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my life. What is this doing here? Okay. And I hear Dr. Hales say in my right ear, this is 1978. This is the memory I'm used to. Listen, you want to tell me how this patient got on the ventilator? We're pulmonary. That's what we're here for. Basically, not to gawk at women. Okay. And the next one in my head was pulmonary. This is a crap about pulmonary. Look at this woman. Anyway, we're married 41 years now. This is the first time I saw my wife. So I think I was like preset to fall in love with a blonde. And then to top it all off, we're in a very nice restaurant in Boston. I'm sitting there. And again, I'm shy with women. I'm no ladies' man. Okay. And no one ever accused me of being charming. And in walks an attending in pulmonary that I knew very well. He's about 3 or 4 years older than me. And the next day he comes over to me and says, how did you get her to go out with you? And I said, well, I don't know if you're trying to insult me, but I'm not bad looking, okay? And I have a brain. I asked her, and she said, yes, I didn't kidnap her, okay? And she said, and he says to me, well, I've been asking her to go out with me for months now, and she keeps turning me down because she's engaged. Didn't you see the huge rock on her finger? It's like thousands and thousands of dollars. And that's how I knew, wow. And I looked, because I'm not going to ask somebody out who's engaged or married, because why would I want to get shot down? I'm shy. I never saw the ring. Okay. I never saw this ring. Okay. And again, just yesterday, I'm thinking that the supernatural world opened up to me on October 15th, 1982. In the book, I walk into Tears Church in Germany, of all places, okay, having hated Germans all my life, which is another take-home message. Don't hate people, okay? And so we're on this bus to go see Neuschwanstein, this castle. It's gorgeous. And of course, she's there, okay? I'm not going on a vacation for 6 weeks with the Uriel Pass without her. But in the book, she's not there yet, okay? So that's a difference in the book and real life. And so the bus stops in the middle of nowhere. And everyone goes to the coffee shop to eat something, drink something, use the restroom, except for me. And because I didn't have to do any of those things. And across the street is this church, Tears Church, that I didn't know the story of. I walk in there, and the story is there was a stick figure of Jesus being scourged that they used to use in the Good Friday procession. And everyone agreed it was ugly, so they tossed it in the barn for a couple of decades until somebody realized there were actual tears coming from Jesus in this thing. So they put that in the altar and they built this church. I didn't know the story. All I know is that it was a beautiful church. The walls have the Stations of the Cross. It's a Catholic church. It's gorgeous. The ceilings are gorgeous. But your eye is drawn to this ugly thing at the counter. So I'm sitting there looking at this, and then I get this message. I don't hear anything. It's like somebody is talking directly in my brain. Like I'm speaking to you, okay?
Right.
Your brain is interpreting the words and then telling your brain what it means, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's at the speed of electricity. So you think it's happening at the same moment. But in reality, there's a little bit of a pause. And here it's coming right in my brain. There's no pause, okay? And I don't hear anything, but the message is, I love you, your sins are forgiven. So suddenly I believe in God. It's like a little bit like St. Paul on the road to Damascus. And I'm thrilled, I'm all excited. And my wife sees that something is up, okay? And we're checking out of a very inexpensive hotel. And our goal was to sleep overnight on the train to get to Vienna the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And I say to my wife, hey, let's celebrate. Let's go to a great restaurant here. We can go to the next train because we have a Euro pass. Not only we have a ticket for this specific train. So I asked the clerk at this very inexpensive hotel, where's a nice place to eat? He says, probably the restaurant at the Four Seasons Hotel. So I said to my wife, let's go there. And he looks at us and said, you can't get in there. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, you have sneakers and jeans and backpacks, and you need a suit, you need a gown. And plus you need a reservation. It's a small restaurant. It's Friday night. So I remember thinking, nonsense, of course we're going to get in. The creator of the universe just communicated with me and I want to celebrate, we're going to get in. So we run down there, and it's late now, okay? And there's a man at the front door, a doorman, dressed through the nines and top hat. And I ask him where the restaurant is. He said on the second floor up the banister. And then he says, look, let me take your backpacks. I'll give them to you on the way out. Like, basically, we don't allow people dressed like you with backpacks in our lobby, let alone to eat here, okay? So I go upstairs. And the maitre d' has a tuxedo, the piano player has a tuxedo, all the waiters have tuxedos, all the guests have gowns and suits, and there's us. And so he asks me my name, and I give him my name, okay, S-O, you know, whatever. And there's one empty table with a reserve sign on it. He takes the reserve sign off, and my wife said she saw our last name on it, which I didn't see. I didn't notice that, okay? And then we eat there, and it's like the meal of the century, okay? We had everything, hors d'oeuvres, appetizers, everything, and the piano player is playing this song. So I asked the waiter if he knew the song. He says, yeah, it's a famous song by Michel Jarre. It's called A Man Like You and Me, which is the title of the book, A Man Like You and Me, a Supernatural Adventure Story. That's how I got there. And
can I just interject for 1 second? Because I was just really curious, because your story is really amazing. And your book is absolutely amazing. And I was just wondering, you know, exactly how, you know, if you could tell us a little about what type of creative process you went through, because, like, you know, it was a very complex subject matter. You know, your whole life, you know, was really complex. You had a lot of obstacles that you endured. And can you tell us a little about your creative process? Like, how did you develop the story? How did you actually come up with the characters? And
it's a very good question, okay? And the answer is, I'm not a writer, okay? And I basically was told by God, write the book,
mm-hmm.
okay? And the character in the book, I'm the physician in the book, okay? It's really, I'm that guy, okay? So I'm writing about myself. And the beautiful blonde is my wife. Okay, those are really the two characters in the book. There's really very little anything else in the book, okay? And
right.
The events happened, okay? It's a chronological thing as it happens, okay? So the book starts, chapter one is October 15th, 1982, when I walk into Tears Church and get suddenly converted, okay?
Right.
The only thing that's different, and then chapter two is, we're now arrived in Vienna, it's evening time, it's time to eat, okay? We have a guidebook, and I look up a restaurant near St. Stephen's Cathedral, because it's a plaza there, okay, and there's a lawn Vienna that you can't have a building higher than St. Stephen's Cathedral, so you can see it from everywhere. And I don't like to ask people questions, you know, how do I get from here to here? Just go to the plaza, you can see it, okay, and then remember how you got there and go back. So again, we're at this at this place, and again, the restaurant's on the second floor, and there's a dim light coming from the second floor where the restaurant is. And we, I walk in, it's a glass door with a wooden frame, and I walk in there, and my wife is in front of me, and clearly it's closed. And then I turn around to walk out, and we're locked in the lobby, we're locked in this hallway, okay? And I can't get out. And I know, being a Pullman fellow, growing up in New York City, that there's a law in every country, every Western country since 1921. What happened in 1921? There was a fire at the Coconut Grove nightclub in Manhattan. Okay, and for some reason, the people are locked in and they're burned alive. So there's a law in every Western country. You can lock the place. If the place is closed, nobody's there. You don't want people to rob the place when it's closed. You can lock it there. But once you open the door and people are let in, you can't lock them in. And I can't get out. And I know this is weird. I don't know, that this is like I'm in the Twilight Zone or something, okay? Then I tap on the window and a guy with dark hair comes over, a nice man, to try to open the door for me. And he can't open the door that I just opened easily, okay? And now I'm kind of really worried, okay? And then I look back where my where the light was, where my wife was, and I see a Christmas tree for about 5 seconds. Then I see an Easter candle for about 5 seconds. And then I see the face of Jesus and I'm petrified. He's not smiling. He's not happy, okay? And then I turn around and I'm trying to get out. And the night before at the restaurant where we were, my wife wrote this list, okay, of seven things with a dash in front, and then one dash is empty, okay? And one of the things was St. Bridget, okay, St. Bridget of Sweden, all right? Anyway, I'm petrified. And suddenly a lady with blonde hair walks to the door, walks over, and lets us out. She opens the door, and we run out like scared mice. And I remember saying to my wife, we're eating at the next restaurant we see. I don't care about the food. I need to be where people are, where it's normal, okay? I don't know what the hell Twilight Zone that was, but that was scary as all hell, okay? So we wound up eating at the Lucky Chinese restaurant. And I hate Chinese food. So we like Thai food, okay? It's spicy, but the Chinese food is not. And I remember sitting there talking to my wife saying, this is perfect, okay? There's people here. There's waiters here. I don't know what Twilight Zone that was, but this is normal, okay? We haven't had Chinese food since then, by the way, okay? There's no reason to have it. But anyway, so this is what really happened, okay? And the only thing that's different in the book from real life is, in the book, she doesn't believe in God and I do, okay? And it's completely the opposite. She's Roman Catholic, went to Catholic high, goes to mass every Sunday, every holy day, and a lot of times over all the weekdays, okay? And then when I got a job working at Astra Pharmaceuticals, I had to drive an hour and a half each way, so I would get there for mass. And I'd go to mass every day at St. Luke's Church, okay, in Westboro. And again, St. Luke was a physician like I was, and he's the only evangelist who was not Jewish, okay? And so I always thought it was kind of funny, okay? You're running around from place to place trying to convert people, okay? You might eat, you know, the wrong food and get sick or whatever it is. It's nice to have your own physician with you. So let's get this guy to come with us, you know, whatever. I always thought it was kind of, you know, and so many supernatural things happened there, okay? One of the times I'm saying the rosary in front of this icon of Our Lady of Vladimir, okay? After mass, and there's a sound, like a buzzing sound, coming from the wall, right wall there, and there's like a compartment in the wall, like a metal compartment. So I asked the priest, you know, what's in there? And he opens it up, and there's three bottles of holy oil, one for confirmation, the middle one was anointing the sick, and one is for the dead. So I asked him for the middle one, because in my mind, everything is symmetric in God's world. And that was the one for the holy oil for the anointing of the sick. And he gave them to me. He says, here, you know, have some. So I have it to this day. You know, that was in the 1980s. And there's other things that happened in that church also. And one of them was, okay, it's the end on July 9th, 1987, okay, I'm leaving mass. And I get this kind of message, look up, and I hear church bells, okay? And it's the church bells of the church that we're in, okay?
Right.
And again, I asked the priest, you know, what's the significance? And it's 34 bells. And I asked the priest, what's the significance of the 34 bells? And he says, it's 40. So I said, well, obviously somebody made a mistake ringing the bells, because like the Angelus prayer, the first three, three, and three, and then the regular ones, so I know where it started, okay? And he said, nobody's ringing the bells, okay? It's on a tape. And subsequently, I listened many, many times. It was always 40, but that time it was 34, okay? And then another time, it says, look up, and with some other church. And so I go to that church nearby, and it's a Protestant church, and they had a whole ceremony that was empty of a healing process. The church was, the session, the ceremony was for healing. And, I thought, oh, maybe that's what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be praying for people, and they're supposed to be healed. Okay. It goes like that. And here's the bizarre, the most bizarre thing of everything. Okay. We're on a train, October 13th, 1982, in Germany. It's a crowded train. My wife is standing in front of me. We're in the aisle. About 10, 15 feet in front of him is this crazy guy with a knife, and they're screaming at him in German that I don't understand. Okay, and suddenly he bolts down towards my wife. And a normal person might just jump out of the way. My wife is athletic. She sees this. She's brilliant. Okay, she'll do the same thing. But that's not what I did. I grabbed her shoulders and threw her on the lap of somebody, okay, to my left, okay? And then I kept my weight on her so she couldn't get up. There's no way this guy with the knife could reach her, okay? Unfortunately, I'm still in the aisle.
David found a pension that his staff would love. He chose NatWest Cushion because it has a fantastic app that is easy to use. Everyone feels good, except David. He is ecstatic. Take a little more action with a NatWest Cushion Workplace Pension. Tomorrow begins today. Search NatWest Cushion. Capital at risk.
Okay. And by the grace of God, my whole right side is closed. And he's got a knife in his right hand. And by the grace of God, he didn't stab me as he went by. Okay. He had to actually move the hell out of the way not to stab me. Okay. And then he goes into the next car, and everything's fine now. And I let my wife up, and she doesn't even say thank you. Okay, this is Saint Mary Beth. Okay, like if you carried her groceries to the market from to a car. Okay, she'd say thank you. This guy risked my life for her, and she doesn't even say thank you. And for years, I prayed to God. I said, "Explain this to me. This is the perfect human being. This is the closest thing I'll ever see to a saint. How does she not say thank you?" Okay, and then I got this disease, Hashimoto's encephalitis. On March 25th, the feast day of the Annunciation, 2019, and my memory was wiped clean. Okay, I didn't. Most of my long-term memory was wiped out. I had no short-term memory. I was a moron. I'm driving, and suddenly I don't know how to drive, and I don't use a cell phone. And I get admitted to the hospital. I'm on chemotherapy, steroids. The MRI of my brain looked like a Christmas tree. Eventually, the parts of my brain responsible for memory—I'm left-handed, so it's the right hippocampus and right temporal lobe—were destroyed. I'm an absolute moron. Okay. And then I kind of the take home message was the reason she never said thank you is because the evil one came and wiped it out of her memory immediately. So she doesn't know it ever happened. Okay. That's the explanation for this. And then, of course, so I'm sick. And now everything that I had that I valued as far as this great memory, this great immune system, where I appeared like I never got sick. My kids would come from school and say, hey, Dad, how come you never get sick? They're coughing and giving it to the other brother, going to my wife. Three of them are hacking away, and I don't get sick. I said, I'm a human being. I get sick like everyone else, but for an hour. Okay. And then this immune system kicks in and kills everything. It's gorgeous. Okay. It's great. For my father. And that's gone too. Okay. I'm on chemotherapy three times the FDA approved dose, and I'm like the basket case. Okay. And once eventually I had no memory, and I called a priest that I knew and said, hey, is it okay if I stop eating and drinking? Because this is not a life for me, and I have no brain, and my wife is suffering, having to deal with this. Okay. You talk to any person who has a brain injury and talk to their spouse, it's very difficult for the spouse. Okay. It's not just the patient is sick, it's a hardship for both of them.
Oh,
So
definitely.
he said, go for it. Okay. God will understand. You won't get, go to hell for committing suicide. But then, one of my providers who read the book and said, hey, if you think your job is to get this consecration done with the bishops and the and the Pope in this specific Catholic Church in Moscow, you can't say no to him. It's kind of like, okay, God says to Noah, build the ark, and he says, no, I'm not building the ark. You know, find somebody else. You're certainly going to go to hell, and that's the only reason I'm still alive.
Now, when you wrote this book, what was your main purpose when you talked about these supernatural stories in your book, and you mentioned, you know, when you created this whole, you know, supernatural story, what was the purpose behind this book? What was your motivation?
The motivation was I wanted to have people to have the feeling that I had as an atheist to suddenly realize that God exists. And the people who believed in God had to increase their faith, okay? And the reason that I say that is because this, something happens during the day, okay, in real life, okay? Mm-hmm. And then if you read the book, you'll see there's the mass reading of if you went to church that day. And a lot of times it has some kind of meaning. So
yes.
If you read the book, you would actually be reading a large chunk of the New Testament. You know, and so the person who may not have been exposed to that will automatically be exposed to it. So it's kind of like a way of getting people to read the Bible, okay, in a way,
right.
In a nice way. And of course, I asked the American Bible Society, you know, for permission to do that, and I sent a letter, and I said, I need it, you know, they sent a letter saying, no, you don't have that many citations there, so you don't need to, you know, you're good. You don't need any special permission. You know, we give you permission. Okay, so I, you know, try to do this in the right way, and everything else. So again, the purpose of the book is to increase faith in the reader, and I feel like a complete failure because this is like God's task to me, and nobody knows about the book. It's the marketing has been awful. Okay, and that's kind of what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get people to know about the book, read the book, and increase their faith. Okay, again, there's something in it for them. Okay, their life will change. Okay,
after this show, everybody will know about the book. But my question to you is that with all these medical issues that you've gone through, how did you stay focused? Because writing a book is very difficult. It doesn't matter what, you know, gene you're writing about. It's very difficult to write a book. You have to stay focused. How were you able to stay focused with memory issues, with all the illnesses that you went through, all the ups, you know, hill battles that you had to
endure? Right, but even right now, I still have the peripheral neuropathy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So my fingers don't work, my feet are numb. I fell down a flight of stairs here a couple of weeks ago and broke my wrist. Okay, but like an idiot that I am, I don't want my wife driving me or whatever it is, so I never got a cast. So there's a big bump in my right wrist, and it matches the scar in my left wrist. How did I get the scar on my left wrist? I'm intubating somebody, and the law at Dr. Lyon's pulmonary department is you don't sedate the person until after they're intubated, okay? Because if you sedate them first, they might stop breathing. Okay, so it's always like, I feel like I'm in a rodeo. The guy's out of his mind, he's swinging, okay? And I'm left-handed, so the laryngoscope is in my left hand, and he's digging his nail into my wrist in the left hand, trying to pull that away until, you know, then I get the thing in. And once it's in, then you can sedate him, okay? Then the battle's over. But it's kind of like a rodeo, okay? The guy's out of his mind doing that, okay? But I try to follow the rules, okay? And, you know, whatever.
Well, how did you stay focused? It was, you know, it's very difficult staying focused.
It is a difficult thing. And again, I wrote the book in 1988. So the book was basically written then, okay, but I edited it. And there was a lot of editing changes. The main editing change is the name of the church. Okay. When I wrote it in 1988, I was kind of told it's not supposed to happen with the bishops consecrating Russia to her Immaculate Heart of Mary with the Pope in the Vatican, which is the typical place it should be, because the bishops meet with the Pope there several times a year. No, it's supposed to be in a church in Moscow. And then, like, you know, since I edited it, I was told the name of the church. It's Church of the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin Mary in Moscow,
mm-hmm.
where this is supposed to happen. And I'm supposed to be there, okay? And again, I keep thinking, I'm nothing in this world. Like, you know, I'm the least important person in this world. I'm not the head of a nation. I'm not anything. I'm not the head of some union. I'm not anything. Okay. So why am I picked? And why wasn't my wife picked? Okay. because she could convince anyone to do anything, okay? I mean, I've been married to her for 40 years. She's spending that time convincing me to do everything she wants all the time, okay? I'm the object of this, okay? All right? And so, again, it's a little bit of a sitcom. And again, the best part of the story, as far as I'm concerned, the writing part of the story, the funny part of the story is I put the scene where that happened in the train, I put it in a bakery, and I make her look better, okay? She's there, she's working for the CIA, she's supposed to, this is her last assignment, she's had a spotless career, after that she's going to be in an administrative position running agents, okay? I'm the last one, okay? And all she has to do is get me to this consecration without, you know, untouched, okay? That's her job, okay? And I put this scene of the crazy guy with the knife, but I put it in the bakery, and I make her look good. Okay, she sees the guy, she tosses me into the side, I'm in some kind of pile of rolls, okay, and she's ready to take care of this guy, all right?
Well, don't give out too many information, because you want the readers to be able to, you know, you don't want to give away too much, you know.
Anyway, there's a funny episode here, okay, and part of it is, there's a spot of blood on my shirt, okay, so this would be a catastrophe if the people from the CIA saw that, because it would mean she failed, okay? And so I say to her, let's go to a hotel and we'll spend the night in the hotel. We'll give them the shirt and they'll clean the shirt. In the morning, I'll have a clean shirt, okay? Nobody will know. And she says, they'll never believe that I'm going to bed with a pig like you, okay? And having sex, okay? In the book, all right? Like, the people at the CIA will never believe that, okay? So, you know, my line is, well, you know, this is supernatural stuff. You don't know what, you know, all things are possible. We don't know, okay?
Right.
So she calls up, and they believe it, okay? And she's so freaking insulted, okay, that, you know, they would actually think that I was having sex, that she was having sex with a pig like me, okay, whatever it is. And then there are other things in real life that are astounding to me, okay? Again, I'm not a ladies' man, and I'm 31 years old when I meet her, okay? And I was always kind of late with as far as this puberty stuff, okay? So I didn't have to start shaving every day until I was in medical school. And I had no hair on my chest, you know, when I met her also, okay? And so suddenly I meet her, and for whatever reason, I'm growing hair on my chest at the age of 31, and I'm shaving, like I have to shave twice a day, okay, to not look like a bum, okay? Everything is being changed in the, and you know, and in the book and in real life, I'm thinking to myself, do I have an endocrine tumor? Okay, you're not supposed to be going through puberty at age 31. Okay, this is not normal. Okay, and then I realize, okay, she prefers men who have hair on their, or whatever the heck. I'm being molded for her likes, for her, you know, whatever the heck it is. And it's kind of like, it's in real life and it's weird. Okay, it's beyond weird. Okay.
And do you have a copy of the book you can show everybody right now?
Absolutely. Okay, the front cover has a quote from St. Paul. It's a definition of love. Okay, love is patient, love is kind. And at the end of it, it always perseveres. Okay, it's from 1 Corinthians 13. St. Paul, who's the writer? Okay, and my son Paul is the writer of the family, not me. Okay, so that's the front of it. The back of it has about the author and also a picture of a baseball batter. Okay, about the author says, you can take the boy out of Brooklyn, but you can never take Brooklyn out of the boy. Always a Brooklyn boy. I mean, I may have done a pulmonary fellowship at Mass General Harvard, but I'm still the guy from Brooklyn. And the picture of the batter is because in baseball, and again, it's a national pastime, although I tried out for the Bridgeport Jets football team, having never played football. It's one of the anyway, in baseball, the batter comes to the plate hoping to get a hit. And I don't care how great a hitter he is. Most of the time, he makes out. He fails, okay?
Right.
And the take-home message is, we're all sinners. We all fail. We get to God. We get to heaven by the grace of God. That's what that's for, okay?
Yeah.
And again, there's complicated aspects of life in this book about fate, free will, and all those things. And again, I was kind of told to write the book, okay? I'm not a writer, okay? So
right.
So yeah, editing the book took a lot of willpower, And now I think it's perfect, you know, as far as it's making the points that I want to make. And again, at the end of the book, there's an epilogue. The epilogue is unchanged from 1988 when I wrote it. And again, there's all these citations of mass readings, okay, in the book, in the citation. So the person who will be reading a lot of the book. And again, in the last part is the Psalm 91. And to me, 91 stands for the evil one. Mm-hmm. Why? Because he led Jesus, the man Jesus, to the top of the temple and jumped, and then quoted Psalm 81, 91. He said, the angels will keep you from injuring your feet. Okay?
Right.
So to me, that's where that number comes in. And again, the back of it is... the book was written in the 1980s with the copyright of 1990. Many, but not all, the events described before that day occurred as depicted in the novel. Many additional supernatural events occurred but were not included. All the events after 1990 were fictitious but followed an inspired plot. Like, I didn't want to say anything bad about President Bush or Vice President Quayle or Pope John Paul II or Cardinal Rohr or Cardinal O'Connor or James Baker. Because I'm trying to get to the Pope to have him consecrate Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, and going through these people, okay? But there's an epilogue, mm-hmm. and at the end of the epilogue, okay, that was written in 1988. It has about the Red Sox that they finally won the World Series, okay? That they were cursed, okay. It's now 10 years after the day when I first visited Moscow. Mr. Gorbachev and the communists are wealthy capitalists now. Everything they, quote unquote, planned for the consecration of Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary went according to their schedule. The world realized it was saved through the intercessions of Mary. Everywhere people are going to confession, praying the rosary, and receiving communion, blah, 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 blah. I moved back to Boston and have four children now, James, Paul, Peter, and John. Okay? They each have blonde hair and hazel eyes. Neither of them sleeps much. Okay, they're all smarter than I am, and the CIA has promised not to recruit them. I married the ideal woman. At first, after the consecration, I thought both the CIA and KGB coerced me to marry her, but that made little sense because following the consecration, when 91,000 sick people were miraculously cured, again, this 91, okay,
mm-hmm.
the grace of healing that was given to me was taken away. It's just as well. The children need a normal life. My family and I would have been hounded by the public. Mary Beth and I were married 2 years after the consecration. It was obvious that I was a has-been. I spend my summer days driving to the ballpark, rooting for the Red Sox, the New England Red Sox. I built a stadium in Rhode Island, which is identical to Fenway Park, with a short, high left field wall and a screen above it. When you're in the game, you think you're in Boston. The Boston fans drive over to attend the games. They are now the great... They are the greatest fans in the world, and now they are rooting for the world champion, New England Red Sox, who won the World Series twice in a row. Who would have believed? Okay, so there's a little bit of baseball in there also. Again,
it sounds pretty amazing. Where can people find this book?
Well, they can find it on Amazon. They can find it on Barnes & Noble. They can find it on my website, okay, which is pauljoelbook.com. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's on Facebook. It's on LinkedIn, whatever the heck it is. And I hope to have an e-commerce website set up so they can just one stop. And again, if you look at the website, there's certain things from the book to kind of get you interested in it. And then you can order it on that website. But you can click on it and it goes to the Barnes & Noble and Kindle. You can order Kindle as an ebook if you look mm-hmm. the right way. And again, it's a soft cover, it's a hard cover, and it's available on Amazon, Ingram Spark, Kindle, Barnes & Noble.
Excellent, excellent. Now, do you have more information on your website besides your book that people can learn a little about you and maybe some
other stuff? Yes, but a lot of it is about the book and certain readings in the book that kind of to get you interested.
Okay.